The joint venture requirement under quid pro quo requires multinational firms to form joint ventures with domestic firms in order to gain access to the domestic market. Every cars produced in China, be it from joint venture or domestic firms, improved in their quality over time significantly. So there's definitely significant benefit to Chinese consumers.
Welcome to Vox Dev Talks. My name is Tim Phillips. FDI is often done using joint ventures. And for that, the foreign firms get market access and their local partners get access to knowledge and technology. Those foreign investors, well, they might often gripe about forced technology transfer. But does the policy succeed on its own terms? That is, does it benefit the host economy and its consumers? A new paper examines the impact of these type of joint ventures on China's fast-developing auto industry. And Xie Bai of the Harvard Kennedy School is one of the authors. She joins me now. Welcome to Vox Dev Talks.
Thanks, Tim.
Explain a little bit more about these joint ventures. Who sets the rules? What are the rules? Who enforces the rules?
Yeah, thanks, Tim, for the question. And thanks very much for the invite. It's a great opportunity actually for us to share what we've learned from the paper with the VoxDev audience. So just a little bit on the background. So quid pro quo is also known as the technology in exchange for market access policy. Mm-hmm. And the joint venture requirement under quid pro quo requires multinational firms to form joint ventures with domestic firms in order to gain access to the domestic market. So to be very specific, in our context, the Chinese auto industry, the policy says in order to produce and sell cars in China, for example, GM has to form a joint venture with a domestic automaker in order to produce and sell cars. And there's also a strict cap on foreign equity, capped at 50% in this case, and that is binding in all the joint ventures that we see in the Chinese auto industry.
Is it just China that does this? I mean, China's very well known for doing this, or do other countries do it as well?
Yeah, restrictions on foreign investment were actually very common in developing countries. It was very common, especially before the 1990s. And a lot of those restrictions were removed during the 80s and 90s as the, you know, during this wave of economic and trade liberalization, as advocated by international organizations like IMF. But I would say even today, a lot of the restrictions still remain in certain sectors defined to be, you know, strategic sectors in big emerging economies, including China, India, Brazil, and other developing countries. So it is still very common in certain sectors these days.
What's the rationale behind this? What are the benefits in detail? Also, what are those concerns? I alluded to them briefly, but tell me more about that.
Yeah, that's a great question. So there are various strategic considerations in imposing restrictions on foreign investment. Now, in our context, one of the key rationale is to really facilitate learning and knowledge transfer. The idea is by forming the joint venture, we're able to allow the domestic partner to learn more from their foreign partner and be able to build up their own technological capacity over time. And so, you know, it's true that these joint ventures indeed help to expose the domestic firms more directly to foreign capital and foreign technology. But the key concern is that a lot of the multinational firms actually consider it to be a kind of a forced technology transfer and a key barrier to enter and invest in the host markets. So quid pro quo lies at the front line of the China-US trade debate, and concern over quid pro quo was one of the key stated justifications for the Trump administration's decision to impose tariffs on $60 billion worth of Chinese imports in 2018.
And specifically in China, you focus on the auto industry. How common has this quid pro quo arrangement been? Is it just for the auto industry? Is it for every industry?
The joint ventures themselves are very common in many manufacturing and also non-manufacturing industries. Mm-hmm. Like, for example, we see that in the auto industry, but also in the upstream parts and components industry and many other manufacturing industries. What is unique about the auto industry is that we only see joint ventures. We never observe wholly owned foreign automakers operating in China. Whereas for many other industries, you observe a mix of different ownership types. You know, we have the joint ventures with different percent of foreign equity. You also observe wholly owned foreign firms and also alongside with domestic firms. But in the Chinese auto industry, because of the quid pro quo policy, all we observe is joint ventures capped at 50% foreign equity.
Right at the beginning of this paper, you write that we don't really know very much about what the advantages are of this type of forced joint venture compared to unrestricted FDI for the host. Why don't we know that?
There have been a lot of studies on the impact of FDIs, in particular about the impact of FDIs on domestic firms via knowledge spillover. You know, the FDIs could be a wholly owned foreign firm or could be a joint venture. And I would say there are relatively fewer studies that tries to look at the differential impact between the different forms of FDIs, joint venture versus wholly owned foreign firms. And that's really the key policy debate here, that is there any additional learning benefit as a result of ownership affiliation, which is the key feature of quid pro quo in the Chinese auto industry context. And I think the literature on FDI has paid relatively little attention to whether and how the form of FDI could matter. And, you know, the empirical challenge is really to isolate this additional learning benefit due to ownership affiliation, you know, compared to unrestricted FDIs.
Yes, empirically, what has research tended to measure in the past if it's trying to work out whether this knowledge transfer is effective? And, well, seeing as we're looking at your research, what are you measuring? Are you measuring the same things?
Yeah, if we look at a lot of the studies that tries to quantify the impact of FDIs on domestic firms in terms of knowledge spillover, a lot of the studies have been mostly relying on TFP. It's a total factor productivity measure at the firm level to measure knowledge spillover. And that is really in some sense like a black box. So what we're trying to do in this paper is really trying to look beyond just a measure of total factor productivity and tries to provide more concrete evidence of learning and knowledge spillover. And to do that, we're going to exploit a rich data set that contains product level, so car model level quality attributes that really embody the firm's fundamental technological know-hows. And we're going to use that to design a novel empirical strategy to try to detect knowledge transfer.
I can understand how this is much more satisfactory, but how on earth do you define quality in this context? And where do you get the data? Who's measuring it and who makes it available?
Our quality data came from JD Power, which, according to industry experts, provides one of the most trusted and reliable quality measures for the auto industry, not just for China. They do this for many countries. Basically, JD Power, every year, they conduct two large-scale consumer surveys, two quality studies. The first one is called the IQS, Initial Quality Survey, and this will survey a large number of new car buyers and ask them to report the number of problems they experienced during the first 90 days of ownership. We think of this as giving us an objective measure of the malfunctioning rate of the vehicle that people bought. And the survey asks many questions covering a wide spectrum of vehicle functionalities. So that's IQS, that's the first study. And at the same time, JD Power also conducts another study, which is also based on consumer survey. And this is much more like a user satisfaction rating of the vehicle they bought. It's called Appeal. Appeal study also covers more than 100 vehicle attributes, and then JD Power grouped all of the different attributes, detailed metrics, into different performance dimensions, ranging from, you know, safety measures, interior quality, exterior quality, fuel efficiency, driving experience, and that's really what we're going to exploit. It gives us multiple dimensions of the vehicle performance measure for basically the universe of vehicles sold in China during the time period.
So if I understand it correctly, you are using the data on all these quality metrics for cars built in China before there were joint ventures, after these joint ventures, and seeing if there is improvement.
So that would be the ideal design. So ideally, you would want to observe the quality of the cars built before the joint venture formation and after. Mm. And another thing that you would want in the ideal experiment is that these joint ventures were somehow randomly formed. And yes. Then, you know, we can then compare the, you know, affiliated domestic partners and the non-affiliated domestic partners, comparing their quality before and after the joint venture formation. And that would identify the impact of the joint venture affiliation on quality upgrading. There are two challenges in our context. The first one is that, you know, a lot of the joint ventures were actually formed in the 80s and 90s. In fact, the big ones were formed in the early years. Mm. But the quality data from IQS only started in the early 2000s. And in fact, it's not just a data availability issue. It's a fact in the sense that a lot of the Chinese domestic automakers did not even have their own models prior to 2000. You know, in the early years, in the 80s and 90s, these joint ventures, they were mostly just producing existing models of the foreign automaker. And really, the indigenous domestic models only started to appear after 2000. So it's not just data availability, it's just that there weren't any domestic models to look at before the joint venture formation. So that's the first challenge. But the second challenge is that, you know, this wouldn't be a problem, actually, if the joint ventures were randomly formed. You know, although we don't have pre-period data, but if they're randomly formed, we can still compare their outcomes over time. But that's also not the case in this context, because there is a lot of selection. It could go in different ways that may bias our result. And just observationally, all of the joint ventures were formed with big state-owned enterprises, whereas a lot of the non-affiliated domestic automakers are private enterprises. So SOEs and private firms, they're different in many different dimensions, as we learned from previous studies. So this is far from being a random selection. So we will have to account for both of these challenges in our empirical strategy.
As soon as you start getting into the detail of this, it's very problematic, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. So that's what we hope that we are bringing this new empirical methodology, which really leverages this multidimensional quality measure within the firm product. So our research design follows a very simple intuition. The idea is, if we think there are additional learning benefits through ownership affiliation, then we would expect that these affiliated models, domestic models, would look more similar to their joint venture models compared to non-affiliated models. So for example, just to give some intuition here. So we know that German brands have a relative comparative advantage at, you know, engine performance, safety measures, whereas Japanese models are better at fuel efficiency. And these indeed show up in the quality data that we have. Different foreign leader models have different relative strengths. So the key empirical strategy that we're basically looking for, does the domestic model that is affiliated with a foreign model adopt similar relative quality strengths as their leaders, controlling for the average quality of the follower model? So the idea of looking at relative quality strengths within the firm product allows us to control for a lot of the potential confounding factors that you may think of, such as, you know, their selection based on maybe foreign firms, they're picking better domestic partners to form a joint venture, but we can control for the average quality of the follower of the domestic firm, and really exploiting the relative quality strengths within the firm. And also, along the same spirit, we can also control for a lot of the industry-wide time trend. You know, for example, during this period, everybody improves in their quality. Yes. There's industry-wide improvement in, you know, powertrain system, in navigation system, in safety system, but we can control for all of that.
So during the period that you have data, does the quality of cars that are produced by joint ventures, does it improve by how much?
Yeah, that's actually the first thing that we looked at in the data, using the raw quality data that we get from JD Power. You know, if we take the IQS, the initial quality study, which tells us the malfunctioning rate of each vehicle over time, if we take that as an objective measure of quality, we can look at the time trend. Mm-hmm. The first thing that we find is that indeed for the joint ventures, you know, these are the leaders, right? These are the GM models produced in China, BMW models produced inside this joint venture plant. Yeah. What happens to these leader models over time? And there you see a dramatic improvement in quality over time, even for the leaders. So to give you some concrete numbers here, in 2003, that's the beginning of our data period in the early days. In 2003, the joint ventures, you know, they started off with a higher quality compared to the domestic models. You know, for the joint venture models, on average, we see 278 defects, malfunctionalities reported per 100 vehicle. It's a very high number.
Mm.
Now, if you look at the time trend by the end of our sample period, by 2014, the malfunctionality rate, the defects rate per 100 vehicle decreased to 94. For the joint venture models. So yes, the leaders also improved during this period of time. And there are many reasons, there are many factors that could be underlying this overall time trend, you know, such as rising income, increasing competition as a result of China joining WTO. All of this would, you know, lead to firms to try to upgrade their quality.
So then how does that compare with the cars that are made by domestic manufacturers that are not part of a joint venture? Are they improving as well? Are they improving as much?
Yes, they are. In fact, we observe a remarkable convergence or catch-up in terms of quality by the domestic models produced by Chinese automakers themselves. And that's true for both affiliated domestic automakers and also non-affiliated domestic automakers. You know, a lot of the private automakers, they produce cars that became better and better over time. And in general, this catch-up pattern is quite striking in the data. And again, to give you some concrete numbers, you know, again, in the early days in 2003, the defects for domestic models were as high as 500 per 100 vehicle, you know, compared to, I just said, 278 for the leader models. So there was a big gap in 2003. But by the end of the data period, by 2014, and we see that, you know, that gap has shrunk a lot. So for the affiliated domestic models and also non-affiliated, their average defects rate dropped to 120-130 compared to 94 for the leader models. So there is, over time, it seems that the Chinese models are indeed catching up.
So explain to me why this is happening. First of all, with the joint venture manufacturers, is this because of new research that is being done as a result of the joint venture, or is it just because of that knowledge transfer, they just get better at making the cars? And what on earth is happening in a domestic market?
So a lot of factors could be driving this pattern of overall quality upgrading and overall catch up. So I think an important factor is rising domestic income. And what that means is, you know, with rising income, there's a rising demand for quality, for high quality.
Yes.
You know, in the early 2000s, many Chinese car buyers, they're all first time car buyers. Over time, I think people indeed become much more knowledgeable about cars. And as they become richer and more knowledgeable, there's a higher demand for high quality cars. And that itself is going to lead to greater competition on quality. And that can incentivize both the joint ventures and also domestic firms to upgrade their quality. There's a big push-pull factor from the demand side. And now on the supply side, there's also a lot of policy initiatives to try to encourage indigenous innovation, indigenous creation of indigenous brands.
Mm-hmm.
And at the same time, you know, with WTO, entry into WTO, the import tariffs came down. And that leads to greater competition with imported models, imported cars. And I think all of these are at the background that will be contributing to this overall quality upgrading and quality catch-up that we observe in the data. So back to the research question, the key empirical challenge is to really try to isolate, you know, how much of this catch-up that we saw for the domestic models could be attributed to joint venture affiliation, to ownership affiliation.
How much is it?
Yeah, so using the empirical strategy that I described, we first documented reduced form evidence that's consistent with knowledge spillover. I should say greater learning benefit as a result of ownership affiliation. So we do find that affiliated domestic firms indeed produce models that look more similar, share similar quality strengths as their leaders compared to non-affiliated domestic firms. So that is consistent with learning and knowledge spillover. And in the paper, we did a host of robustness checks to try to rule out confounding alternative stories, such as, you know, endogenous joint venture formation, selection of partners, and other stories you may have in mind. And then taking the reduced form evidence, we then build a simple, we then calibrate a simple learning model to try to then quantify the overall impact of quid pro quo of this joint venture affiliation on domestic upgrading. And we also try to quantify the impact on sales and profits. So what we found is that this additional learning benefit benefit due to quid pro quo during 2007 to 2024 contributes to about 1-4% increase in sales of the affiliated domestic models. And there's a range because we experimented with different specifications of the learning dynamics. And we try to be conservative and we try to put a bound on the benefits. So it's 0.9 to 3.9% in terms of sales. So overall, I think the results suggest that it's while quid pro quo indeed facilitates learning, its impact on domestic sales and profits are relatively modest, taking into account how much sales have increased during this time period.
One way perhaps that we could think of this is that the benefit comes mainly to Chinese consumers who are getting much better quality cars.
That's true, indeed. And that you can see from the overall upgrading trend that we document in the paper, that every cars produced in China, be it from joint venture or domestic firms, improved in their quality over time significantly. So there's definitely significant benefit to Chinese consumers.
If an automaker wants to build cars in China, it must form a joint venture and own no more than 50% of it. But that's about to change. China will lift joint venture ownership caps for foreign OEMs by 2022, a rule that has been in place since 1994 to help bolster China's fledgling auto industry.
On the 1st of January 2022, the Chinese government lifted this joint venture restriction. Do we know why it changed the policy?
Yeah. So as we said at the beginning, I think, quid pro quo really lies at the front line of the US-China trade debates. Now, because of the emphasis on technology transfer, this policy has been criticized as a, state-initiated effort to systematically pry technology from foreign companies. And if you read the 301 complaints, concerns over quid pro quo was a key statement there. So I think a lot of the part of this lifting of the quid pro quo, the joint venture restriction done by the Chinese government was a response to that rising tension between the two countries to try to, the government basically pledged to further open its domestic market to foreign investment. In the context of the Chinese auto industry, this means that they will effectively allow foreign automakers to have solely owned production facilities in China.
You can see why that's good news for foreign automakers, but given the quality improvements that you have found, the quite dramatic quality improvements you've found, can we interpret this as perhaps being bad news for China's domestic automakers and for its consumers?
I think what we found in the paper is that ownership affiliation due to quid pro quo does help to facilitate learning. But the quantitative exercise that we did at the end of the paper also shows that the impacts appear to be modest. So my takeaway is that the recent policy change to remove joint ownership requirement may not significantly hinder the quality upgrades and sales of the domestic automakers. At the same time, it may actually allow foreign firms to change their incentives, with majority stake or even, sole ownership. Foreign automakers may actually have stronger incentives to bring the most advanced technology into the Chinese market, and they might offer a different set of products as they can better guard their know-how. So, such responses may actually benefit the Chinese consumers. So in general, I think it's still an open question to really understand more in future research regarding how foreign firms' incentives to introduce technologies into developing countries are shaped by knowledge spillovers and shaped by FDI policies of the host country.
Well, that's the present and the future, but I'm going to take you back to the beginning of this podcast and back to the beginning of the policy. Can we say that these quid pro quo joint ventures in the Chinese auto industry delivered more than traditional FDI would have done?
That's a great question. Only if history can go back. Now, I think what we've done in the paper is that we tried our very best to try to quantify the impact of quid pro quo on domestic upgrading and sales during the time period from 2007 to 2015, which we think is the most relevant period in terms of quality upgrading. Because if you look at the data, that's really the time period when the domestic firms start to take off. They started to introduce their models after 2000, and we saw this dramatic upgrading and catch up during that time period. However, that's relatively later period, starting from 2007 to 2015. Although it's a relevant period in terms of a lot of the quality and sales dynamics really you know, take place. But I think you're asking an even bigger counterfactual, which is what would have happened to the Chinese auto industry if quid pro quo was not there in the first place? You know, if we go back to the 70s, to the 80s,
yes,
if from the very beginning we would have allowed for wholly owned foreign firms to operate in China, what would have happened to the whole industry by now? That, I think, is a very big counterfactual question that's very hard for any one of us to answer because we just don't observe this big counterfactual. But we can do some speculations. You could imagine that the policy may be more effective in the early years, you know, to allow the domestic economy to quickly build up their production capacity. But it might become less and less relevant as time goes, and at some point may actually start to impede the introduction of foreign technology, as we hear in a lot of the current debates. What I think we can take away from the study is that quid pro quo, you know, by now is not, you know, during the time period that we started to looking at in, you know, from the early 2000s, it is not the primary driver of quality upgrading during that period. And therefore, you know, going forward, lifting the policy will unlikely have a large impact on the quality dynamics of the domestic firms. And so I think we do speak to the contemporaneous relevance of the policy, which is linked to the current policy debate. But the bigger, you know, historical efficiency of the policy, that's still very, I think the jury is still out. And it's a very hard question.
Yes. And as you said, the countries that tended to impose these joint venture restrictions, Brazil, India, China, they had quite a large manufacturing base, maybe not of the quality that they wanted at the time. Now, for other countries, smaller countries that maybe don't have that established manufacturing base, but would really like to impose these sort of joint venture restrictions for FDI, is this something that they can still copy? Should they be copying it? If they did, is there a good way to do it?
I think clearly here, there is no one-size-fits-all type of policy here. Actually, if we look at a lot of the existing work on FDIs, you know, FDIs, including both joint ventures and also wholly owned foreign firms, it's also becoming increasingly clear that the impact of FDIs on domestic economy, on domestic firms, you know, in terms of how much the domestic firms can benefit from the entry of FDIs, that is very, very heterogeneous across contexts, across countries, even within country, across industries. It's just very big variation in terms of how much FDIs could actually benefit the host country. And I think the key question for policymakers to think about is, why are we seeing this heterogeneity? You know, a lot of that depends on, as you said, you know, the scale of the domestic markets, but also depends on the, you know, what we call the absorptive capacity of the domestic firms. How much can they benefit from the entry of FDIs? That, you know, leads to the discussion of a lot of other key barriers and constraints that firms may face, and that pushes us to think about complementary policies, supporting policies that may, you know, work hand in hand with FDI policies to try to really unleash the full potential benefits of FDIs.
As ever, it's the details that really matter. Qi, thank you.
Thank you.
The paper is called Quid Pro Quo, Knowledge Spillover and Industrial Quality Upgrading, Evidence from the Chinese Auto Industry. And the authors are Zhu Bai, Panlei Jiabawik, Sheng Mao Kao and Sanjun Li. This has been a Vox Dev Talk. The best way to make sure you don't miss an episode is to subscribe. Wherever you get your podcasts, you'll find us there. If you do miss an episode, go along to voxdev.org. You'll find all our past episodes and also articles about the papers we feature.